Great. Thank you so much, Scott. Thank you for having me on this panel. Thank you to Left Forum. I'm very pleased to be here today. So I want to talk a little bit, the resistance that has arisen since the election or selection of Donald Trump has been quite extraordinary. When I think about it, I'd like to think in contrast with what happened when Ronald Reagan was elected in 1980. It was his election that first propelled me into activism as a teenager in Wisconsin, much as many people are being propelled into activism for the first time now. That too was an election that greatly shocked people on the left and represented a dramatic turn in American politics. But the contrast, when I look back at what happened then, from the perspective of organizing and resistance, is that came after a long period of retrenchment and crisis on the left over the course of the 70s, where a lot of movements were doing some profound thinking about how to reorient themselves. A lot of movements had turned inward. A lot of people had moved to long-term strategies of institution building, which were powerful and important, but also represented a realistic assessment that it was time to kind of dig in and step back and think about the long term rather than be engaged in dramatic confrontation. And I think the contrast with what we have now is that this cataclysm in American politics came after quite a few years of rising activism and organizing in the U.S., a period we can date back certainly to Occupy, and then the many, many movements that have spun off since, the work that had been done by the People's Climate Movement, the Black Lives Matter protests, the Standing Rock Sioux protests. We haven't just had a period of rising activism. It's also building on a period where there's been a lot of really deep thinking about organizing and resistance. In particular, a lot of people, a lot of scholars and thinkers came away from the experience of Occupy to think really deeply about strategy and organizing. And there's this wealth of wonderful books that have come out in recent years that offer a lot of insights into what kind of organizing and resistance works. There's been some very powerful work about what kind of civil resistance works against authoritarian regimes and has worked around the world, what lessons we might apply here. So we come to this moment, we have this rising resistance, and which has had, I think, a very striking character. Arun was describing the Black Bloc as the most visible edge of it, but that really has not been characteristic of what we've seen in the streets. That is a tiny, tiny, tiny part of what has happened. It's been amplified in the mass media as it often will be. But we've seen there again are these scholars who are looking, so we actually have data about who's out in the streets now, which I don't think people did to the same degree for past movements. So we know that there are hundreds of thousands of people out in the streets who have never been active before. And we know that they're mostly women. We know that it's mostly women who are participating in the resistance that's happening now. Depending on the context, some of the studies of the street protests in DC have found that to be something like 57 to 59% women. When you look at some other statistics, like who's been making phone calls to members of Congress, the number jumps up to 86% women. And there's some metrics by which the numbers are even higher. A lot of these people are newly politically active. Some people want to characterize them as liberals, and maybe they are, and maybe they aren't. Many of them were Hillary Clinton voters, but they're also in the midst of a process of political discovery and reassessment that I think you know, in the organizing work that I've been doing with people who fit into this category, I think there's an openness. I don't think people are necessarily coming. Certainly, people are not joining the resistance. Profoundly attached to a neoliberal vision of politics. I think there's an openness and a fluidity, and where people were coming from is not necessarily where they're going to end up. So I see a lot of promise in that character of who's becoming activated now. And the other quality is that there's that certainly the people who've been coming, the protests that have happened have built on the long-standing work of many different organizations and groups, but we're also in a period where a lot of people are starting their own new groups and their new formations. And so there is a kind of immense amount of different containers for all of this energy right now. It's a very, very decentralized movement. We've seen things like the most dramatic example would be what's happened with the Indivisible groups, where some former members of Congress posted a guide for how to take action and pressure your elected representatives following something of the model of the Tea Party. And there are now 6,800 groups around the country taking that guide and translating it into activism. They are not centrally coordinated in any classic sense. These aren't like chapters in some classic sense. It's a much looser structure. And that looseness is characteristic of a lot of other initiatives. There's the people power groups that the ACLU is getting started. There's local groups through Move On. There's a lot, there's the 5,000 huddles from the Women's March. There's all these different little local groups. The overall strategy that people have been following is a very simple two-prong strategy in this moment, which is disrupt and build. It's disrupt as much of the harm as we can and build for the long run. But that looks like many different things in many different segments of the movement. Scott, in his opening remarks, was asking about the question of a grand coalition, of some kind of organizational vehicle that might pull all of these disparate parts of our movement together. And when I look at the history of what's happened with our movements on the ground, this incredible decentralized networked resistance that we have now, this is the culmination, this is the direction our movements have been going for a long time. For decades now, movements have tended to kind of vote with their feet away from single integrated organizational strategies, a lot because people have been looking for autonomy and voice in their movements. A lot of this has to do with identity politics, with gender and race, and with the ways in which and sexual orientation, and the ways in which people have wanted to have those whose voices have been marginalized in the past have not been eager to subsume themselves into some single organizational entity where they won't have strong autonomy and voice. But that said, I think people are very interested in new forms of coordination, solidarity, and alliance. So I think there's an old dream on the left of bringing everyone, of unity, of bringing everyone together into a single organizational vehicle or a single grand coalition. And frankly, I think that comes up against what you might call the Bartleby problem. It says that people, they would prefer not to, that people like to work together contextually. So for example, a huge array of folks came together in the People's Climate Movement and have really done powerful work to reframe the whole question of climate activism away from the kind of white dominated environmentalist framing into a broad climate justice framing. But that doesn't mean that people are ready to kind of shed their separate organizational containers and their separate agendas as they come together and work together. So, you know, there have been these really interesting and powerful models of how we might have these new forms of networking and collaboration and where that might go. I think the two areas where I think, so sorry, let me just rephrase this for a second. Movements, much as they did in the 80s, I think we're seeing a lot of focus now, a very pragmatic focus on shifting to local organizing of various kinds. People are looking for winnable victories, whether they're looking in the electoral realm and looking to flip their seat, flip their district, or whether they're looking to see ways to implement changes at the local level that will help protect immigrants and refugees from deportation and roundups. So there's a move to engage in new ways at the local level and at the electoral level that are combining in a lot of these indivisible groups and other rubrics. It's not clear yet how independent that work is going to be from the Democratic Party. I think it's an incredibly promising trend, all of this energy to re-engage with the electoral and legislative work, if it remains autonomous from the Democratic Party and serves to transform the party from the grassroots up. If you look closely, for instance, at the indivisible groups, there's a huge range. There are some of them that are feisty and independent. There are others that, frankly, are vehicle for exactly the version of Democratic Party politics that contributed to getting us into this mess. I know, you know, one of the Brooklyn indivisible groups, you know, their strategy session was led by Chuck Schumer's legislative strategist, not someone I think of as, you know, a leader of the resistance. The resistance school, I guess this goes back to what, you know, Arun was saying, people are using resistance in many ways. The resistance school at Harvard, I haven't sat through all the sessions, but close as I can tell, that's elevating the demobilizing strategy of the Democratic Party, the wing of the Democratic Party that is committed to demobilizing its grassroots base in order to empower its corporate donors and use big data as its organizing strategy. So you know, resistance means different things in very different contexts. The experiments that I think are really worth keeping an eye on now and building as part of this this swirl that we're in as people are thinking about how to take this incredible wave of energy and translate it into effective and long-term resistance. I think the experiments with mass non-compliance are very, very interesting. The biggest being the Day Without Immigrants. This is building on work that has happened in the immigrants' rights movement for a long time, and which is drawing on strategies really pioneered in the Global South. So it's, you know, what does a general strike look like that's not mediated first and foremost by labor unions, right? We have, you know, labor has declined for so long in the U.S. that it's not, if we're going to have some kind of mass non-compliance labor, for a lot of reasons, organized labor is unlikely to lead it. That's been picked up by the women's strike and is a really interesting model to think what would it look like if on a truly mass level we withdrew our cooperation with this regime? What might we accomplish? What power might we have? And the parallel approach is mass resistance. We've seen a lot of protests. We've seen a lot of marches. We've seen some blockades. But mostly, we haven't yet seen a lot of nonviolent direct action. We've seen a lot of protest activity that has been very powerful. And that is bringing people in and serving as an important channel. Arun was talking about what happened on Inauguration Day in D.C. Well, everybody saw what happened with the Black Bloc when they had their anti-capitalist march at noon, but not that many people saw actually what happened earlier that morning which was a really powerful and beautiful thing. A lot of people were scared to come to DC and engage in direct action, and they were partly scared because they were scared of what was going to happen with the Black Bloc. They were partly scared because they were afraid what was going to happen with Trump supporters and whether people were going to get beat up. But a few thousand people did show up, and they blockaded six or seven of the 13 entrances to Trump's inauguration. When you look at those aerial photos of how small the crowds are, you can see there's a whole area where there's nobody at all. And that's because people were having, were engaging in blockades and were actually keeping the delegates, the attendees rather, from entering. And they were, in some ways, it was a microcosm of our resistance. Each one was organized autonomously, and they each had a separate character. I started the day out at the Queer Bloc one, which was great because I got anointed with glitter, which felt like, you know, a nice sign on this terrible day when Trump was going to be inaugurated. And that was just, that was like a dance party. So anybody who wanted to go to the inauguration could get to the checkpoint, but you had to walk through a queer dance party to get there. The next one was organized by the Black Bloc. And I want to give them credit for this. They don't always go around and do knuckleheaded things. They sometimes do smart and strategic things. And in this case, they sat down three deep, arms locked. And for people to get into Trump's inauguration, they had to get pulled over this line of Black Bloc folks, you know, right on. Like, people got kind of kicked in the way people got into the inauguration, but only by being pulled over. Then there was a no dapple blockade. People used lockdown devices. They used lock boxes, those PVC pipes, and completely shut down the gate. It was a powerful, they had a prayer ceremony, this powerful blockade. There was a Black Lives Matter blockade, where there was a theatrical tableau. There was a climate activism blockade. All of these people working together in a coordinated action, but each of them having the character of the separate movements. It was a powerful model. Again, many people don't even know it happened because it got overshadowed by everything else. But it's a model of what mass resistance might look like that I hope people are going to explore. I think part of what sustained me over the long haul is just a temperamental optimism. So what I'll leave you with, obviously these are some of the most frightening times I can remember. I do remember the fear of nuclear apocalypse in the Reagan years. This is not unique. We're not the first generation to feel that the world is crashing down around us. But I'm encouraged by the character of the resistance that I see. I think people are very serious. People are asking good and strategic questions, and people are thinking, not just about how to express their anger and their frustration. People are really thinking about how to resist effectively and how to build something effective for the long haul. Thank you very much.